Hey everybody, it's Norm from Tested. Before we jump into this week's episode of Still Entitled, I want to thank the sponsor of this week's podcast, and that sponsor is VideoBlocks. Today's episode is brought to you by VideoBlocks, and it's a subscription-based stock media company that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage that anyone can afford. Premium content at a great value, and everything is 100% royalty free. Get your subscription today for only $99 at www.videoblocks.com/x/untitled. That's www.videoblocks.com/x/untitled. And now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Hello, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good evening. Good night. Sorry, we do that every six or eight months,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. I just rewatched Truman Show.
How is the Truman Show?
I love that movie. I watched it in a pairing with Pleasantville.
I was going to say EdTV.
And Pleasantville, Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire. Yeah.
Yes, and I think those are great pairings.
I can see that.
Pleasantville has one great failing as a script.
Which is?
So the plot of Pleasantville is that everyone lives in a black and white world, and then Tobey Maguire starts to be able to see in color, and he starts to infect other people with the ability to see in color, right?
Yes.
We understand this allegory.
And it's a sexual awakening for a lot of the characters,
yes,
or just a character development.
It's a self-actualization awakening and sexual awakening for all these characters. But there's a point at which hey, it's that guy, J.T. Walsh, who plays the villain in the movie. Am I right?
Who's J.T. Walsh?
J.T. Walsh is, if you look him up, you're like, oh, that guy. He is the ultimate hey, it's that guy.
Oh, okay.
So he's like the murderer from Sling Blade. He's the producer from The Big Picture. I know I'm naming esoteric movies, but J.T. Walsh was in everything for the longest time. He died a few years ago. At any rate, the black and white townspeople start getting mad about the people who are in color, and they start calling them the coloreds, which to me is the point at which your allegory has fallen to pieces.
Kind of, because,
because you've vend your allegory onto reality wrong.
It's too on the nose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You're absolutely right. I'd forgotten about that.
They could have been
My whole life to give that diatribe.
Have we talked about my Wall-E theory? Speaking of viral knowledge through a movie.
Go for it.
I think Wall-E's about the singularity. So I think Wall-E contains the spark of self-awareness. And when he touches Eva and that spark goes across, he's communicating that to Eva and then all the rest of the robots on the ship.
Oh, fascinating.
And I say this because I have a 3-year-old and I've watched Wall-E probably 100 times in the last year.
You've had a lot of time.
I've had a lot of time to think about it, and I've had a lot of exposure. I love movies like that where you have this idea and you get to watch it propagate out through a network of fictional characters.
Totally.
And I hadn't thought about Pleasantville as one of those movies, but it totally is.
You're right. You should also, I guess, watch, what is the, EdTV? Is
that
the
one with Woody Harrelson?
Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey.
Prior to True Detective,
and I think the same year that Truman Show came out.
It is.
It's one of the duos.
It was one of those, back Armageddon style. But
Batman
versus
Superman, Captain America, Civil War.
I still think Pleasantville and Truman Show because Truman Show, even though it is about live streaming and broadcasting your life, it was about the picturesque, mid-century life.
And the American ideal.
Yes.
EdTV, on the other hand, directly, I think Justin of Justin TV, which became Twitch, cites that as that seems fun.
What was the first, who was the first cam girl?
Jenny, what's her name?
Yeah, Jenny Cam.
Yeah. There was a follow-up, what happened to this girl 20 years later?
I saw that, I read that.
In Salon or something a few weeks ago.
She sounded fairly healthy.
She was always, she seemed pretty pragmatic.
Yeah, I appreciated it. She seemed like she was together.
Mid-90s internet celebrity.
This is airing a couple of weeks after this happened, but I had a really rough, I wanted to talk about this a little bit. I was fascinated during the Reddit AMA that I did last week, which is now a couple weeks ago when this is airing.
In R Makers?
In R Makers, that I repeatedly got the question, how do you deal with the fact that when, how do you deal with it when builds go really terribly and you feel terrible about it?
And you're in a kind of unique situation for that, because like if you for a lot of people, if they burn through materials and ruin materials, then they are at a stopping point for a while.
Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't necessarily apply to you, but in a lot of ways, your time that you're spending in that shop is much more valuable to you than say the material, the raw material cost of something that goes.
Yeah.
Kind of
and
sideways.
I've said this before, when you're first starting out, it's materials that are expensive and your time that's cheap. And later it's materials that get cheap and your time that gets expensive. Yeah. And you have to find that balance.
It's important you start when your time is still cheap.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's really important that you start then. But it was, so that AMA happened on a Wednesday morning, and I was right in the middle of maybe one of the most difficult weeks of building I have ever had.
Right. We were there on Monday.
You were there on Monday.
And we don't need to specifically say what the build was, but you were working in, you know, with the bridge port, you were machining things.
I was messing things up all day long. Then you guys went away. Joey came back for us to wrap up the one-day build, just a couple of hours of extra work to finish it off. And I actually talked to the camera and said, this was maybe one of the rougher builds I've done. Now, the work I was doing was really, really highly precise, you know, hopefully museum-quality replicas of certain hardware that I wanted to get right. This is a collaboration I'm doing with somebody who does really amazing work, and I wanted to send them good parts. And I was just in the wrong zone, and I basically had most of a week in which I seriously... So, sorry, just to go back, the AMA repeatedly in our makers, three different people asked long, involved questions about dealing with negative consequences from building. Like, what do you do when you're despondent about how something went? And they were catching me. But one, it was fascinating to me that that was a recurring question because it's an important one. But two, that question caught me right in the middle of one of the shittiest weeks I've had in a long time. Mm-hmm. A week in which I felt multiple times during the week, holy cow, I have no business making things.
The fact that you would think that. See that, but
I just want to normalize the fact that that happens.
Everybody thinks that.
Everybody feels that way. Yeah. I mean, everybody has at some point some piece of an imposter complex going on, especially when, you know, I'm sitting here, you guys are covering this, we're supposed to be getting some great footage, and I just feel like I'm wasting my time continually boning things by going too fast, going too slow, not thinking enough about order of operations, whatever it is. But it was precision work that was... It was, you know, doing machining. Ryan Agata says, you know, machining operations, order of operations is everything.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking through all my order of operations as succinctly and clearly as I could have. And I was really suffering for it from a build quality standpoint and a personal standpoint. And so I really wanted to bring that up, that like this, like you said, it happens to everybody.
I mean, even if you don't have those bad weeks. Like, I was talking to somebody the other day who just did an amazing photography project. We were talking about she just worked on this 3-month project that she was really excited about and was really received well. And then she was done with it. And she was like, well, am I ever going to be able to do anything as good as that again? And I, like, the same thing happens to everybody. Like, yep. I literally said, look, we're not even finished anything. We just released something. And now it's kind of like, well, shit, what are we doing next? People really like that. There's no way they're going to like the next thing as much as that.
Right, right, right.
Why bother? So
and then to tackle the next thing and then feel like you did not succeed right in the middle of it, how did you get over it?
Well, this was part of the thing is that I know this happens. I know this feeling happens. And my mechanism for dealing with it is to just push through it. Just keep on making stuff. So my fidelity is to come in here and work. So that's what I did. I came in on Tuesday and I worked. I came in on Wednesday. Joey and I wrapped that sequence. I came in on Thursday and finished a part that some material had arrived for. Again, a lot of these builds are going to come up on one-day builds, so we're not spoiling them. And then after I tackled that last bit of hardware, I was like, you know, there's a project I've had sitting off to the side for a long time, and it's a much different project. It's organic. It involves materials I haven't used before. It involves technology that I have been thinking about but haven't really explored, some stuff I learned recently. And I just dove into it. Now, this happens to me sometimes, is I will be working on a build and it'll involve the next step of the build will involve a process that I have to kind of work myself up for. And I was amazed at jumping into working with, it's a sewing project, but jumping into working with this material, which I was unfamiliar with and haven't played with before. It was like that was the wheelhouse that I needed to get back into.
So was it something that was easy or something that's new or just you just needed to fire a different part of your brain off for a little while?
I think it was firing off a different part of the brain. Yeah. It was like jump into a material you have no former experience with and try and get something out of it. And I got something out of it. It wasn't perfect and there were some learning difficulties with it. But that was what broke me out of the rut of doing high precision machining work had sort of captured me in.
So you did something that needed to be good enough rather than something that needed to be perfect.
Yeah, but also it was a change of pace.
A change of pace. And even when you're working a different set of processes, more organic.
Right, and when you're working on maybe project A, even in the back of your mind, you're maybe thinking a little bit about project B.
Oh, yeah, constantly.
And that accumulation helped you when you pivoted to project B get a nice jump start on it.
And that pivot really did sort of surprise me with how invigorating I felt to work with a brand new material and a new process.
But the important thing isn't the project or what you did. It's that you got back. You know, the old saying: you get back on the horse when you get when you get thrown off.
Success is failing repeatedly with enthusiasm.
Right.
Curious how this applies to athletes, because when they get into a rut, they can't change things up. They sometimes have to do the same thing.
Well, it depends on the athlete.
You're right. There's like
they don't have the luxury.
There's endless stories of things like professional runners getting totally boned by trying to change their running form in tiny ways,
or golfers trying to change their swing, or tennis players, or whatever. Yeah.
Look, there are ways in which you approach your practice. There are, I would imagine, I think it is analogous, Norm. I think there are ways in which it's analogous. Like, if you're a sports person, you're attuned to what you know and don't know about your sport in a really deep way. And so I could see this being it's not like I'm not going to go out. And if I'm a golfer, it's not like I'm not going to go out and play around, but I might play a very different round or on a very different course or with a very different mindset.
Change the stakes.
That's what the thing that was killing me was. I was doing hard-edged, high-precision, hold on.
Bless you.
I was doing hard-edged, high-precision model making, and I wasn't in the mental space for getting that kind of work done and pivoting to a new material, but a more organic sort of sculptural form of making was the thing that broke me out of the rut. You know, it was surprising to me to spend like 4 days of a week feeling really crappy about making. Slightly destabilizing.
Everybody has, but I mean, the important thing to reiterate here is that everybody who makes stuff, whether you're a screenwriter or a director or, in your shop or a sculptor or whatever, everybody has off days.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm so glad for that question in our making. I want to pipe back into that subreddit. It's a terrific subreddit. To talk about exactly that. There's a need to discuss that. I mean, this actually goes to me why making itself is, look, it's my mechanism. It's my hammer. So everything to me looks like a nail. I said this in the AMA. I think of making as the gateway drug to critical thinking. And I think one of the things that it gives you is whenever you set out to make something, I guarantee you, you will not end up with the exact thing you thought you were going to make. It's going to be different in some way. It's going to inform the process, the material, the procedure, the collaboration will inform a slight shift. The path is never perfectly linear.
And what you take away from that path is that's the benefit and the utility.
Exactly. Yeah. If you always knew the outcome of what you were going to do, you might as well You'd just be rubber stamping something single day.
There is a place and time for that. But so, what do you do to get out of the rut? What, like this time, you went and started a different project. Do you like? Sometimes I go read. Like if I'm stuck writing, I'll just go sit down and start reading books. Right?
Yeah.
Which isn't always possible, but is the luxury that I have a lot of times.
Yeah. I love Mary Carr. said that when she has a writer's block, she just chooses a piece of writing she loves and copies it longhand.
Oh, wow.
And she said, my fidelity is to sit at my desk and write. What I write isn't as important as the fact of the writing itself.
Well, I think this
To me, it's getting back into the shop and continuing to make despite the fact that it doesn't feel like I know what I'm doing.
I think that's a lot of the, like when you look at novelists who are really successful, I mean, there's two opposite ends of that spectrum. Like there are many things, right? There's people that sit on one end that write when they feel like writing and they produce unbelievable work and it's good, but it's not at a workmanlike pace. On the other end, you have people like Scalzi who sits down and writes 3,000 or 4,000 words every day or something insane and cranks out 2 awesome books a year on a bad year.
Yeah.
So like you have to find your own kind of pace and rhythm.
Have you ever felt that, Will was saying earlier, that feeling when you finish an awesome project and you wonder, can you top this?
Oh, are you kidding? Welcome to the first half of 2016. I mean, you know, I've just completed a 14-year project, and I'd love for it to happen again. You know, totally, you have postpartum, slight postpartum blues at the end of... I mean, you know, I went down to L.A. a few weeks ago, and we pitched a bunch of networks on a show. And even that, just a full week of pitching.
Yeah.
At the end of the week of pitching, I was like, oh, wow, it's done. And I felt a little sad about it. Look, any kind of significant creative push involves on the other side a little bit of sadness that it's over.
One of our former editors, Norm, told me when I was new that everything you write should be the best thing you've ever written, right? You should literally, and it was a little bit ludicrous because I was writing 18 pages of magazine a month. So, you know, it's a high bar, but you should try to make everything that you do the best thing that you've ever done. And if you can do that, then you're always going to be improving, and it's you know, you're always pushing yourself a little bit harder.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't always apply.
Or at least the most interesting thing that everything you do, the next thing you do should always be the most interesting thing to you.
Yeah, look, ideally,
we're in a unique situation on that front.
But you know, I was just thinking about people who might come to this podcast this week, last week, because of the AMA I did in R Makers, and I wanted to say, and I've said this on the podcast before, back when I was working at Industrial Light and Magic, and you know, I got in at the end of the wire, at the end of an era, and got to work with many of my heroes in a place that I'd been dreaming about working since I was 11 years old. It was Valhalla. And there wasn't a single job that I worked on at ILM that didn't at some point in it include the feeling from me of like, wow, someone's going to come up behind me and tap me on the shoulder and tell me to go home. Because I don't know, clearly don't know what the hell that I'm doing.
Yeah.
That feeling happened on every build. And I just learned that that's part of the process. And so that's the way I dealt with it, is I intellectually understood this is part of the process. You've just got to push past this and it'll be fine in a day or so.
They didn't have a name for it back then.
Imposter complex?
I don't think so, yeah.
No, we didn't. I do believe the DSM did, but I didn't.
There was, if you want to know more about this, the first XOXO, all the talks are online. It was the topic. It ended up, I don't know if they intended for it to be the topic, but it ended up being the topic for most of the talks.
Yeah.
It's the one that you came in on the last day and spoke at. But a lot of people talked about it. And if you go to the XOXO
Dan
YouTube
Harmon,
channel,
I think, did a tremendous job of talking about
fabulous
that.
Fabulous talk.
That guy is fearless about his process.
He didn't come across as, like, he is fearless because he put himself out there in a really personal way.
He really does that.
But yeah, it was super good and highly recommend you check out Dan's, and there were several other talks as well that would be relevant to the conversation. So I guess that'll do it for us this week.
I think this
cool.
is
cool. So this weekend is Maker Faire, Bay Area
oh.
Maker Faire.
Oh, wait.
Will's doing a talk on Saturday.
Talk about cheeseburgers and smartphones.
And Adam's doing a talk on Sunday.
Yep.
And also
1-2 punching it with the gingers at Maker Faire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ginger
Punch
City.
In there.
Boom.
There's also at the end of this month at the Exploratorium is going to be an exhibit we've been waiting for a long time.
The amazing Theo Janssen.
Theo Janssen, Strandbeast at the Exploratorium. It's a traveling exhibit. I think
Strandbeast.
Strandbeast?
Strandbeast is what I've been told on the comments section of Tested.
He's Dutch, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It was in Chicago previously and now in the Exploratorium Science Museum.
Is he actually setting up full size?
I think so. I don't know the exact, but we're going to be covering it on the site. So we're very, very excited.
I just want to see an army of them rolling up Embarcadero.
You and me both.
Yeah. What would that do to traffic? Well, thank you guys for listening. We'll be back next week. See you at Maker Faire. Hopefully, if you see us, say hi.
Absolutely.
Norm, are you going to be there shooting videos
yes,
and stuff?
Yes, we'll be there Saturday and Sunday.
Excellent.
Also, yeah. No, that's great.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.